we were
March 44.
By June, we were getting Lancaster pens. These were Canadian Lancasters, built in Canada, mm-hmm. ferried over. And I finished my tour with that squadron on Lancasters.
What was the comparison? How did they compare?
The Halifax II was a pretty old aircraft by that time. I can't recall when the Halifax first came online in Bomber Command, but it would be probably about 39 or 40, and here it was 44. The aircraft were in good shape, but they were they weren't as powerful as these new Lancasters we had coming in. We could take a bigger bomb load in the Lancaster 10, and it had a better ceiling and had a better performance all around. It flew a little faster. And losses during those first 4 or 5 months, they were easing off a little. These were all, at the beginning, these were all night operations we were on.
What were the targets?
We were after the marshalling yards in Belgium and France. We were doing
in preparation
for D-Day coming up. We weren't mm-hmm. aware of this at that point in time. We were doing a lot of what they call gardening. This was dropping of mines in along the French coast. I see we were gardening at Kiel, gardening in up in the what's the entrance to Oslo, Norway, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Gardening off Amsterdam, into Stuttgart, Stettin, Brunswick, Bremen, Kiel again, Dortmund. I never did get further east than Stettin. Stettin, you may remember, was port town east and north of Berlin, but I never did get a Berlin. We were starting to train then, though, for daylight operations. Bomber Command had been almost exclusively night operations. And the day operations, I see the first one I did was in July 20th. Of 1944, and that was a new experience for all of us, seeing your own aircraft in the air in quantity.
You would have, would the Mustang be in at this point too?
Yeah, Mustang was in supporting these daylights.
Well, that's what made them possible, isn't it? Fighter support made daylight bombing
fighter support
feasible, I guess.
Made it feasible, although the Americans had been going in with them.
Losing, getting clipped every time.
Getting zapped pretty badly, but they, of course, went in formation. We never did go in formation as such. We went in a thing called a gaggle. And as the word sounds, it was a gaggle. It was just a clump of aircraft at various altitudes, sort of tucked in mildly close, but not a tight formation. Well, rather difficult to protect, but it's what we used.
What about the Flying Fortress and the in their formations? Were they that effective, or did you have a chance to really see them?
When we were on daylights, we could very often see American formations some distance. When we were doing night operations, if you were flying up England at just after daybreak, and you were flying close to American bases, you could see these aircraft taking off and forming up to start their own daylights. But we never, in my experience, I never did work closely with an American daylight formation.
What was the rivalry like? Did you think you were better than every other squadron, and did you think the RCF was better than the RAF and the Americans and everything else?
We didn't think it. We knew it.
Well, you knew it.
We knew it. We're The only guys we looked up to were the Pathfinder Force. Now this meant you were at the very pinnacle of the operational structure, social structure. If you were chosen to be a Pathfinder, that was something. And we both know General Reg Lane, and of course he was a Pathfinder. And but as far as other squadrons, other nations went, the squadron you were on was the best in the business, and there wasn't a lot of drum beating about it. You just sensed that
we just knew it,
that's all. No discussion.
Didn't have to talk about it.
You didn't have to talk about it, you knew.
But Pathfinders were held in great esteem, though, like 405 Squadron.
Yeah. Any PFF, any guy you met with a PFF badge was a special type.
Now, you were awarded the DFC. Was during this tour, or was your next squadron?
No, it was during this tour towards the end of it.
And the citation was you were singled out for one.
Yeah, I can't remember what the citation was, to tell the truth. And I don't even have it. I don't even have it hung around here. I should. I've got it tucked away somewhere.
Was it a big deal?
Well, you played it down, you know. You didn't make a thing of it, but needless to say, you were intensely proud.
Mm-hmm.
And
looked good on the uniform.
It looked great, you rarely ever discussed it, and people very rarely asked you why. And I think if you had the VC up, you
well, then you wouldn't have to buy a drink.
You wouldn't have to buy a drink.
What about the complaint now, or not a complaint, but the observation that with the vast number of DFCs that were awarded, like the DFC being equivalent to the MC or the mm-hmm. DSC for the Navy, the MC for the Army, that with the numbers awarded during the Second War, they lost some credibility, or, you know, and I'm not trying to be smart alecky here or anything else.
No, I know what you're saying.
There has been this this charge. You, as an operational pilot, I gather, when you saw someone else with the DFC, you didn't think that way. I wouldn't think, would you? Or?
No, but I think latterly they were awarded for sort of more general satisfactory operational conduct.
I mean, almost like a DSO type of decoration.
That kind of thing. That this officer has consistently displayed perseverance in the face of
the enemy
and so on and so on. There seem to be fewer and fewer specific events. But now, every now and then, a pilot would bring an aircraft back that shouldn't have been flown at all and landed safely and saved most of his crew, and you knew that you knew about that event.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no way to grade the color of a DFC. It was awarded for operational bravery, skill. But to return to your earlier point, certainly towards the end they were a more frequent event, and that didn't mean we had more brave people towards the end. But I think the feeling in part was that. If there were cause at all, why not? In a way. Not everyone got a DFC.
No, certainly not.
So there was distinction there.
No, I was thinking more in comparison to the MC or the DSC, which weren't given out as many weren't given out in the Second War.
Yeah, I think in part. It was the frequency with which airmen came in direct contact with enemy violence. Every time you went up, you were and got to the target. You were exposing night after night after night.
And I guess a lot were awarded posthumously as well.
And a lot posthumously. I don't think that denigrates the award at all.
No, and nor do I wish to imply that. All I was getting at was the great number, and I think probably the, not the charge, but the query, I think would probably be like some people can query the merits of the DOC, as you say, probably came after the war, after the fact, and could say, well, look at the number they gave out, all you had to do was be there. That type of statement would come out. But the reason I asked you is because you did have it, sir.
Yeah.
You know, by having the DOC,
well,
I might be able to get, you know.
You have to believe over the last 30 years or so, that question has been asked before, and if one feels that way, one feels that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not aware of in my own group of turning to someone and saying or thinking, you do not deserve the DFC, that your conduct did not warrant it, merit it. But it's an old one. It doesn't bother me to have someone feel that way about it. If that's the way they feel, that's the way they feel.
Well, usually it's those that don't have it that feel that way, isn't it?
Well, in part, but you know, you get it from your naval cousins and your army cousins as well. And jealousy will get them nowhere.
Yeah, well, before we leave that, I guess the other point you must consider as well, though, is that the army, after you hit a certain rank and after you were in certain operations, the DSO and other things came almost as a matter of course. Not that they did, but they were more frequent. And as the Air Force, you got a DSC or the VC, and that was about it, wasn't it?
Well, DSOs were fairly frequent.
Well, but that would be what, group captains and above?
Wing commanders. But it was, the DSO was considered, but always for operational distinction.
Yes.
It was very much an operational award. All of us felt that the Americans were over-meddled, and I suppose within our own fighting forces, one felt one got a better kick than the other. I think it's pointless to spend much time on that.
Now, rank-wise, now you were what at this time when you entered 428?
When I hit 428, I was a flying officer.
So it would be a full lieutenant.
Equivalent
army rank would be a full lieutenant.
Right. I see that I was a flying officer in April. I see that in May I was a flight lieutenant.
You're an army captain.
Mm-hmm. And in August I was a squadron leader. So I went through two ranks, FO to FL, the squadron leader, in about three and a half, 4 months. And by October, I was a wing commander. So what are we saying? April, May, June, July, August, September, October. In 7 months, I went from flying officer to wing commander.
Now, would that be due to the loss rate as well as combined
experienced operational leadership in part, no question. Mm-hmm. Loss rates certainly. We lost a fairly high number of senior pilots, crews in those mm-hmm. days.
Since their number was up, was that the view? Or?
One didn't know with the more experienced operational crews, but we were starting to bring in pretty senior people from Canada. I remember in three or four cases, they had been group captains in Canada and accepted them, or were given a demotion, a rank,
mm-hmm.
a rank reduction to wing commander so they could come across and command squadrons to gain operational experience. Well, these people did the same kind of preparation training, but we lost them. And I've never heard a satisfactory explanation for it. At wing commander level, I remember over three nights we lost three wing commanders, all of them, former group captains back home, very often in the air training plan, and one suspected that they just, because they had been perhaps in staff positions so long in the more senior ranks back in Canada, and then rushed through training, given a crew, and off they went, that they just weren't as up to speed as the average chap who more slowly
Plus being brought along, I guess, as well, when you creep into the squadrons.
Plus being brought along, although there was just so much bringing along that was done.
Yes, of course.
When you hit a squadron, you did your first operation with an experienced crew, the pilot. I did an operation with a crew. I didn't have my own crew with me. They were back at the station. And I did that operation. And I think it was on the following night or the night after, I was airborne with my crew. And that was it. I was checked out. I didn't handle the controls. I didn't touch a thing. I just sat there and observed, you know, the conduct of the crew and the conduct of the captain. And then you were off. And that's about all you had. You did other training. You did air to air. Fighters came up, and you mm-hmm. did fighter affiliation, practice bombing. But all crews did that. Mm-hmm. And I've never really had the a definitive explanation by anyone who might have known more why the loss rate was so high amongst our senior guys.
Pause here. Okay, we're back now. What was it like when you got back from a mission? And as you say, your losses were very heavy. What was it like when there were planes and crews missing? Did you sit around and wait for them to appear, or what exactly did you do?
You usually got back. It varied depending on the time of year. The later in the year, the summer months, you were getting airborne at last light, which would be as late as 7 or 8 o'clock, crossing the English coast, headed in with probably dark, and depending on the penetration of that particular operation. During the summer months, you could be back as early as 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. Winter months, with darkness coming as early as 4 or 5 o'clock, again, depending on penetration, you could be very often be back by as early as midnight, depending on how far you were going in, total flying time. You landed with no RT patter. You just got a green light, come into your circuit, and then you went. You found your own position in the circuit. There was really very little control, but you very quickly became expert at finding the right place to fit in. Then got a green light and came in, landed, taxied to your dispersal. Your ground crew, God, they were wonderful. They were always there no matter the hour or the weather, out there wondering how you did, how things went. Any problems, any damage, it was them that you said, you know, I got a hole in the something, or I've lost an engine, or number 3 tends to overheat, or blah, blah, blah. Then you were picked up by the crew bus back into the parachute section, where you handed back in your parachute, your MAOS, and that kind of thing, your escape kit. You were given an escape kit each time. And then right over to debriefing by an intelligence team, and to a pro forma.
Mm-hmm. Did you have cameras as well?
Yeah. Meanwhile, your cameras had been removed from the aircraft. There's very often a fast development, and very often during the debriefing, depending on when you were debriefed, you had the pictures of your actual drop. Theoretically, the center of the stick of bombs that you dropped, a vertical mm-hmm. photograph. And you were debriefed, and you sort of looked around. You didn't know then, unless it was a particular friend and you were looking for him, that there were none, some, or many aircraft missing, unless it happened to be, say, the squadron commander or one of the flight commanders. And word got around very quickly that the boss had not turned up, was missing. You didn't say missing. He just, and you didn't really worry about it, because there was always the possibility that he'd landed somewhere else. For whatever reason,
those long landing strips off the cliffs there, Dover,
the emergency fields, or coming up country, he could have put it down. It took a little time for that stuff to sift up. It was really only in the ops centers on bases and up at group headquarters and a mm-hmm. bomber command who really had the finger. These formation levels, the finger was really on precisely what had happened. No Wing Commander X had not landed anywhere in England, and maybe probably missing.
So what, this information would filter down, what, a day later or something? Or?
Yeah, by then, well, let me continue. After you debrief, during the debriefing, you probably had no idea. Except if you saw a lot of, if you were debriefed quickly, it meant there weren't too damn many crews back. And of course, some other crews had been in and out, and you weren't able to do any kind of a specific check on them. And the big event after an operation, you always got bacon and eggs. So you rushed over to your whatever mess you were in, the NCO's mess or the officer's mess.
Send it to come back, or
what? Send it to come back. Come back and we'll feed you. And you had that. Very often the bar was open. They give you a drink. You bought a drink. They didn't give you a drink. You bought a drink. And by then, you're probably pretty damn tired. Have a bath and go to bed.
So that's assuming you're at your own station.
And most times you were back at your own station.
What if you weren't?
Well, in the case of big diversions, when your whole station was wiped out and you landed on another station, maybe half your squadron or all of your squadron, and maybe one or two other squadrons as well, landed at another station. This happened a fair number of times. Same sort of thing, debriefed, but now great numbers. Then across to your particular mess for a feed of some kind, and very often no rooms available. Everything plugged up, and you'd sleep in chairs around the mess, or if there was a cloth on the billiard table, you slept on the billiard table. You just found your own found your own place. And we're told as soon as that station operational crowd could find out when you were likely to take off to go back to your own base. And very often it was perhaps early morning fog that was going to burn off by noon. So you got what sleep you could, and then finally got to go ahead back to your base, jumped into your aircraft, fly home. And that was a relatively rare event.
When you did find out, when the word did come down that people were missing and whereabouts unknown, did it lessen because it'd be a day or two later, the impact of the loss, or was there mourning then, I guess, is what I'm asking?
Yeah. I can speak really only for myself, my own feeling. I wouldn't want to generalize from my own experience. You somehow shielded yourself from the reality of it. You still didn't know at that point in time exactly what happened. You know, did they crash land somewhere and all crews get away? Did they parachute and are now on an escape and evasion? You really didn't know. For some time, and of course in some cases you never did know.
Never know.
What really happened to the crew. So you always assumed, I did, always assumed, that they were probably going to be okay. They got out, so if they're POWs, you know, this thing is going to be over in a few months anyway, so no sweat. And of course a high percentage did exactly that. That they were losses, all right. They were losses to our own fighting capability, but they weren't all killed. Far too many were, but so that would go through your mind and would lessen the shock of the event
considerably.
They'll make it. He's a smart guy. He'll probably shack up with some French gal and serve out the rest of the war that way. You know that
was the attitude. Eh?
And that seemed to be not with everyone, but that seemed to be a general attitude.
What about the business of going for Burton? I guess that meant there was no way. That was assured that he hadn't made it.
Yeah, and very often aircraft coming back would crash and all crew perish. You knew that event very very well indeed. But the straight operational losses were sufficiently vague. Fortunately, otherwise this constant loss would have been a
demoralizing.
What a demoralizing. And indeed, the losses as they were had a very clear demoralizing effect. And
I guess the thing I'm getting at is that the movies and the literature of the time, and later one thinks of the crew's coming back and having a drink for their comrade who was lost, and then continuing on with the party, or the other one where they'd sit around and mourn for the evening.
Yeah.
And I gather it's maybe somewhere between those two extremes. Is that right? Or
yeah, you certainly weren't flippant or casual or disrespectful at all. But you there was no ceremony about it. Certainly, as one sees in these war movies, no saluting the skies or that kind of thing. You know. it was in this bomber outfit. It was very much a job, and but all through this period of heavy losses, and they were heavier really in 43 than they were in 44. Although there were enough in 44, the problem was. What was euphemistically called lack of moral fiber, LMF, and it was not a rare event to find a crew or a member of a crew going what we called LMF, and he had just decided no more for him, and these boys were sent off to what did we call them? Sent a few off there myself and I was squadron commander. They were sent off to a disciplinarian depot, where life, I gather, was interesting, tough, very, very tough indeed.
Wouldn't be the full glasshouse treatment, though, is that correct?
Right.
No, would it be that, be like a glasshouse army equivalent, or not quite that drastic?
Not quite that drastic, but clearly the intent was, as I understand it, to make things sufficiently unpleasant there, so that a continuation of his operational tour was a better option.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of an approach. No question about that at all. And you had, as squadron commander, you very often had to have the crew in, and if it was the pilot doing it alone, or a member of a crew, or one or two or more, depending on circumstances, they'd have a long chat about the perils of going LMF. Hang tight, hang in. You'll be okay. From time to time, I'm sure there would be legitimate collapses from the tension, but those were treated medically. But these crews just disappeared. Off they went. I'm talking now in my earlier mm-hmm. squadron days.
Was there anything said about them around the mess?
Oh yeah, you know, it's just bad. Very bad, you know, gutless. this being said by some crews that were just about on the verge of doing it themselves. Very, very bad form, you know. Very bad form.
Now, will these crews be brought back into the same squadron, or will they be shipped to other squadrons?
I don't recall ever seeing a crew back to the squadron from which it had gone.
They probably break up the crews anyway.
Very often break up the crews. I never did run that to ground then.
Well, if you had that type of feeling around the mess, how was the conscription issue and the zombies and all this thing treated?
We didn't really have that problem to the same extent in the RCF.
Understandably, you weren't getting the conscripts in the RCAF, and you had
right.
lots of recruits and things, but still the feeling of having to impose conscription at home for people to do what you are doing, your duty, and those types of things. I was wondering if you could think in that same frame. I mean, not after...
Yes. Well, you know, they were the gutless wonders to us. Anyone who wasn't absolutely operationally gung ho just was a non-entity in the social group. You were whether you really felt that way or not, you just couldn't wait to come to grips with the enemy, and you couldn't
mm-hmm.
understand anyone who didn't feel that way. A lot of acting here too. Particular long discussions on it. We were aware of it. We deplored it.
Was it embarrassing?
Was it embarrassing?
Yeah.
As Canadians not wishing to come. Well, you see, we suspected in our own service that a great many of those that hung back as pilot instructors back home, when we thought that they had opportunities to go operational, and somehow found a way not to do it, whether it was real or imagined on our part. All of us had friends in that category, and we wondered about them. We wondered about them. Sure, they were doing a great job back home, but they were instructors, you know, and that was a soft place to be. And so there was an ambivalence here. There was a mixture of emotion. We had in our own tribe. We had a category, other than the LMF, who never quite arranged to get there, and that gave you a feeling of some support, superiority, and you tended to look down on that crowd. But groups that do stand out, we had a number of Jewish boys on the squadrons, and I've forgotten the exact month. And there's a story, and you may recall, Hitler threatened to execute any Jews captured from the Allied from the Allied forces.
Wouldn't recognize their uniforms.
Recognize their uniforms. And it seemed to me that was about May or June of 1944, perhaps a little later. It was certainly aimed at the flying forces. We were briefed on it, and we had, I think, at the time, on 428, and on 420 as well, a little later on, I think probably three or four Jewish pilots, first class guys. And I remember the squadron, I was a flight commander by then, and I think in one case all of them were in my flight, being instructed by the squadron commander to call them in and offer them the option. This was a risk beyond the call. Did they wish to
change their name?
No.
Even
more than that. First of all, did they wish to? Because the kind of intelligence we understood the Germans had, they knew.
They knew who was Jewish
by name. By they very often had pictures of you. We wondered where the hell they came from. But anyway, no, they were offered, as I remember, to be placed on operational training units in England, not having to fly over enemy territory. And in the case I recall, every one of them said, "Like hell, we're gonna finish our tour." And it seemed to me, around the group, that was the general reaction of the Jewish air crew, that they hung in. I expect some probably opted for the other, but I don't recall any on the squadrons I was associated with, and that impressed all of us. Impressed me certainly enormously. Here these fellas in double jeopardy and brushing it aside, and I don't think they rehearsed that. They may have talked about it amongst themselves, but
probably always in the back of their mind. Of
maybe,
course.
Maybe.
Of
yeah.
course.
That.
Well, the old clock on the wall is ticking along, and
all right.
Had you for a long time today. Thank you very much,
okay.
General Edwards.
Very good.
If I can meet with you again, we can continue on, and we'll pick up from. We'll continue on with 428 Squadron.
Okay.
Thank you very much, sir.
Very good.
You'll notice a difference in tonal quality of the voice. This is due to the batteries being weak while taping session. Therefore, when get on the recharge batteries, the voice seems to be speeded up. However, everything should be audible.